By the time this interview airs, Hillary Clinton will have officially announced her run for president, ending years of speculation of whether she will or won't, should or shouldn't. Do you think the air of inevitability surrounding her run for president has made others in the Democratic Party work less hard? Have they been more passive than they maybe would have been if people weren't so sure that she'd run?
I think the problem that the Democrats have is that she is such a formidable candidate, and I think at this point we can call her a candidate. She's such a formidable candidate for the nomination. And the other person who would be in line to run for the nomination is Vice President Biden, very, very well experienced from his days in the Senate and now, you know, 6 plus years, 7 years vice presidency. But I don't think there's no indication that he would challenge her. And that doesn't leave the Democrats with many people who could run a substantial campaign. And by that, I mean, not that there aren't some good, smart people out there, but very few people who would be able to amass the resources and the political network and the sustainability that it takes to run a full-blown presidential campaign. And so in an odd way, she's in a very unique position. I can't remember a time when we've had an open race for a nomination in which there's been so little competition. And I think that she will run into some problems. One of the problems she has is that she is in many ways running against herself or an idealized version of herself, and that's not easy. It's always difficult to win that race. And so she will be criticized and she will be examined microscopically, and she will have to try to live up to an ideal that will be challenging. It's also possible that somebody who is talking about running, Governor O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland, Jim Webb, the former senator from Virginia, Lincoln Chafee, the former governor of Rhode Island, they're all talking about running in the nomination battle. One of them is likely to break through in some way with some message, some argument, some statement, or she will have a mistake. I mean, it's difficult to go through one of these and not make a mistake. So she'll have a moment of truth or two as she battles for the nomination, and then we'll see what everything looks like. But I think at this point she's in very solid shape, and she will be looking as much to try to reintroduce herself and to get ready for a general election as she will to deal with the nomination.
In your book, Collision 2012, you spend time on the theory that the contest between President Obama and Mitt Romney kind of set the stage for future presidential elections in the shadow of the haves and have-nots. After all, you know, the 2012 race was just after the 2011 Occupy Wall Street 99% movement. And voters were hyper aware of what's really become kind of a standard now in our vernacular to talk about income inequality. So do you think, has your theory changed at all about what the 2016 election will look like as we get closer to it? Will it still have those same strains? You know, will there be other threads that might become more important?
Well, I think foreign policy at this point occupies a larger place in the scheme of things than it did at that time. There's been so much that's happened in the world and so much violence and distress and problems that keep popping up, whether it's in the Middle East or in Ukraine or elsewhere, and a considerable amount of criticism from the Republicans about the leadership of President Obama, which Hillary Clinton will have to take some responsibility for because she was his Secretary of State. So I think that foreign policy at this point looks like an issue that will be, if not dominant, significant in the race. But I think that the issue of whether we call it income inequality or economic mobility or the struggles of middle-class families will be front and center as a domestic issue. I don't think there's any change in that. I think one of the interesting things that's happened over the last 6 or 8 months is the degree to which Republican candidates have begun to look at these issues some sort of fresh to recognize that they need to come up with programs and policies to deal with poverty and income and wealth inequality and economic mobility. And they see that as something that was missing from Mitt Romney's campaign, that Romney was not able to speak credibly enough on those issues, and that the president was able to frame the election in a way that put Romney at a disadvantage, and the Republicans don't want that to happen. And at the same time, Secretary Clinton will be under pressure from the progressives in her party to move farther to the left than she's been, echoing some of the things that Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts has talked about. So in a variety of ways, there's a coalescence of forces that are forcing both the Republicans and the Senator and Secretary Clinton to embrace that as an issue.
We see Republicans kind of now formulating answers to what to do about income inequality. But do you see their plans gaining ground with voters yet, or do you think it still needs some work?
I think we're at such an early stage in that voters haven't paid any real attention to it. And I also would say that at this point, the Republicans have not put a lot on the table in terms of specifics. I mean, to the degree that they've talked about it as something they need to talk about. They've highlighted it as an issue. And in ways in which they've basically said, we think that the Democrats have had now X number of years to deal with these problems. They have not been able to do it. We are going to try to do it. And we're going to come up with our own ideas. I think the challenge for the Republicans is to see if they, in fact, have fresh ideas, or whether they will be taking old policies that Republicans have embraced for many years and simply talking about them as a solution to these issues of income inequality and economic mobility. And I think that's the big test. So far, we haven't seen a lot from any of them. Marco Rubio, who is about to become a candidate, the young senator from Florida, has done some good work on this subject. And I think that we will hear a fair amount more from him about how conservative policies can recapture the American dream. But I don't think any of this has broken through to voters yet. We're at such an early stage. There are so many Republican candidates that it will take some time.
And you mentioned that Secretary Clinton will be facing pressure to go more to the left. She is seen as more of a moderate. And we also had on her latest book tour, she made a comment that when she left the White House, she was broke. Dead broke. Is that something that she is going to need to work on to portray herself as someone who comes from a background of, at least middle class, if not, someone who was, quote unquote, dead broke at one point in time in her life?
Well, that was certainly a mistake on her part. And I think she tried to clean that up fairly quickly, but I think it stuck. I mean, I think that people heard her say that and see the life that she's led for many years, which is a life of significant affluence and traveling with Secret Service protection as a former first lady and a life that is apart from what average Americans live. My guess is that when she begins to get out on the campaign trail as a candidate, she will try to remind people where she came from as opposed to where she has been the last few years. I mean, she grew up in the Chicago suburbs, not in a working class family. Her family had some money, but it was a solidly middle class family, but not of privilege or great wealth or the kinds of things that some other people have grown up with. And I think that she will try to remind people that those are her roots and that those issues have always been important to her, whether as, first lady in Arkansas when she did a lot on education and children's issues, worked for the Children's Defense Fund. I think we'll hear more about that. But it will be a challenge for her because people look at the way she has lived and the kind of life she's led and the fact that she gets more than $200,000 when she gives speeches to certain organizations and ask even whether she has lost touch with where she came from. So that will be one of the challenges she'll have.
And you mentioned earlier that foreign policy, while it wasn't a big player in 2012, 2008, it's in the last year and a half, it's really, really expanded into, the average voter's sphere of what is going on. What is it that voters are most concerned about, do you think? Is it their security? Is it where their tax dollars are flowing outside of the borders? What is it that we're going to see candidates really seize on in a voter's apprehension about who is going to lead the country?
I think at heart it all boils down to security and the question of how secure is my family. One of the things I recall from the midterm elections was observing some focus groups, and they were all women, they were all moms, and this was not long after the videos had come out of the beheadings that ISIS had done, these horrible, terrible videos. And that, in one way or another, kind of raised the stakes for people. ISIS seemed to appear from nowhere to a lot of people. And it was a question of where did this group come from? How have they become as powerful as they've become? What are their aims? And how secure are we? Are we in danger of seeing some of this revisited on the homeland? And so I think that that at heart is one of the issues. And because the Middle East now is in such turmoil, I mean, it's hard to remember a time when the Middle East has always been a cauldron of problems, but it's hard to recall a time in which there has been so much going on, violence in one area or another, whether it's Yemen or Iraq or Syria or Libya. I mean, you name it, and their problems and continuing to wind down the war in Afghanistan. And so people look at that and want to know, what is the U.S. role? And there will be a debate about what that should be. I mean, there's criticism of the president that he has not led strongly enough or forcefully enough. And there's another argument that there is war weariness and the American people are not don't have any appetite to really re-engage militarily in a significant way. And so you have those tensions that are going to play out.
Oftentimes, Democrats are criticized for being soft on foreign policy. So on the right, then, who might come out strongest? Who might have the best advantage coming from where they're at in their leadership history to deal with things like ISIS?
Well, the truth is most of the Republicans have only a modest amount of foreign policy experience. We have a number of governors who are running. All of them have been on trade trips to different parts of the world, and many of them have visited Israel and perhaps other parts of the Middle East. But for the most part, these have been brief trips. They are not immersed in those issues in the way you are if you're president. Nobody is. There are a lot of hardliners in the Republican Party at this point, and I think there will be a kind of a bidding war on the part of the Republican candidates to sound stronger, tougher, more resolute, more muscular in the way they approach things. They will be, as I said, very critical of President Obama's leadership. But I think that the question that they will have to answer is, what is their alternative? I mean, there's universal criticism on the Republican side of the negotiations that are underway with Iran in the attempt to prevent them from obtaining a nuclear weapon. But the question that the Republicans will have to answer is there a better way to try to prevent that? They will argue yes, but they'll need to put some specifics and credibility on the table. We know that the relationship with Israel right now is at a low ebb. They will argue that they can make that better and should. But the question is, do they have an answer that would in one way or another unlock the freeze right now in the negotiations, the absence of negotiations over a Palestinian state? So there are a lot of questions that they have to answer beyond the question of we have to be stronger and more robust.
The campaign cycle, not just on a national level, but a state level too, has expanded to encompass multiple years. A drawn-out cycle has advantages and disadvantages, but the disadvantages seem to be talked about most often. Are there any advantages that you can see
of a long, drawn-out cycle? I think it's just the world in which we live. There used to be a campaign period, and then people would govern, and then there would be a campaign period, and people would govern again. And now governing and campaigning goes on simultaneously, probably to the detriment of governing, because it means that people are in a permanent campaign mode. And when you are tearing your opponent apart on a constant basis, it is very hard then to try to get together with that person or that party to try to make some deals to solve some problems. And so I think what we've seen is, as the intensity and the duration of campaigns has increased, it's made it much harder, certainly in Washington, for the two parties to come together to get things done. I think this is one of the large issues that all the candidates running for president will have to try to address. I'm sure some will pay some lip service to it. I'm not sure that anybody has a credible answer at this point to how they would make that system better. And I know we will hear some of that from Secretary Clinton. Jeb Bush has already talked about that in some ways, and others will too. But some of the others on the Republican side suggest that you can govern strongly from a Republican position. You don't have to make a lot of compromises. That people will follow you. Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, has made this point that you can hold to your principles and you can govern strongly from a conservative point of view. That people respect a leader who stakes out a clear position, even if they don't always agree with it. So there will be some debate within the Republican Party, certainly, about what's the right course to try to change the way Washington operates.
Any predictions for the future of this campaign and, congressional campaign 2016 in regards to the floodgates being open to unlimited money and so-called dark money?
Well, the only prediction I would make is that there's going to be more of it than we have ever seen in 2016. We can already see that beginning to happen. The Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court in 2010 and some other related court decisions have changed the nature of political money in this country. We've seen the rise of super PACs, but I don't think we've ever seen quite the role that super PACs will play in this campaign compared to what they've done in the past. Every candidate for president at this point is trying to figure out a way to produce and create the biggest and strongest super PAC to go along with their campaign. This is a geometric explosion from where we were in 2012. Candidates had super PACs. Mitt Romney's was the most well-resourced, but I don't think anybody thinking this time that the Romney model is sufficient. They want much, much, much more. We've seen Jeb Bush spend most of the first months of this year raising money, a lot of which will go into super PACs, and I suspect he's going to have, compared to other recent campaigns, a big, big number that he'll report soon about how much he's already raised, and we're only just starting the second quarter of the year before the election.
With constant congressional gridlock, legislative power and responsibility has shifted toward states. Small government types would actually cheer this on, saying that states' rights should come first. So in this way, does gridlock actually work for Republicans and Tea Party types long term, even if it hurts them in the short term?
Well, what we've seen is a Republican takeover in many, many states, unlike what we've seen in the past. There are now probably more states under unified Republican control, by which I mean they have the governorship and both houses of Congress. And in many states, they have a veto-proof majority in their legislature. So Republicans are able to do things in states that they are not able to do in Washington. And even if they had the presidency and the Senate and the House, probably wouldn't be able to do in Washington because of the nature of the rules of the Senate, where you need 60 votes to get anything done. So they are pushing forward conservative agendas of various, components in the states. I think one of the things we'll see in 2016 is some of these governors saying, this is what we need on the national level. The model that we are embracing at X state or Y state is what we need at the national level to bring the federal government back into control, in their estimation. And that will be part of the robust debate that we'll see both in the primaries and in the general election. So what's happened as a result of the way we're now seeing things in the states is, we talk about red and blue America, and in many ways, we are seeing those differences writ large in the states, the differences between states that are in Democratic hands versus states that are in Republican hands. They're going in very different directions on a variety of policies, whether it's economic policy or certain social issues, whether it's gun rights or abortion or same-sex marriage. You are seeing quite different governing models. And in a sense, that's the larger national debate that has paralyzed and polarized the country.
Right. And we see that right here, Illinois, blue state, in neighboring Indiana, red state, with their Religious Freedom Act drama that's gone on over the past couple weeks. Back in February, you and your colleague Robert Costa did an interview with Wisconsin Governor and maybe presidential hopeful Scott Walker that was widely criticized. In the interview, you asked Governor Walker if he believed President Obama is a Christian, and he basically said it's a ridiculous question. And other journalists and media critics indicated that it was outside the sphere of legitimate debate. Why'd you ask?
Well, it came in the context of a debate that had been touched off by Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, who had been at an event where Governor Walker was, in fact, the highlight speaker. And he had criticized the president for lack of patriotism. And this is a topic that has been there since President Obama came into office, this question of what some of the Obama people have always described as the otherness issue. Is President Obama one of us, quote unquote? Is he a real American? There's been the controversy about his birth certificate. Was he born in the United States or was he not? There's questions about his religion. He has long stated that he's Christian. But there has been, as you know, on the right, questions about whether he is in fact a Muslim or a Muslim sympathizer. A number of the other Republican candidates asked about what Mayor Giuliani had said, went in a different direction. They said, I do not question his patriotism. I question his leadership, but his patriotism is not in question, and pushed it off the table. Governor Walker had declined to answer that question. He had basically said, I leave that to others. And it was in that context we were meeting him in private during the National Governors Association, and we had asked him similarly about the Giuliani issue, and he declined again to answer that. And so I said, well, do you think he's a Christian? It is a way of trying to understand the thinking of a politician. I know we got a lot of criticism, particularly from some conservatives about it. But there are a variety of ways in which you try to understand better the thinking and mindset and attitudes of a presidential candidate. And I didn't think in any way it was out of bounds. It was not asked in a hostile way. He initially chose not to answer it, simply saying, I don't know. And then, given his right to say so, criticized us for asking the question, which, did not surprise me. And as I say, it did kick off a lot of criticism, but I always felt that it was fair game to ask the question. And I think what's happened over time, I know there was an initial outcry about it, but I think what's happened over time is that people have stepped back a little bit and understood more about why we were doing it and what the context of it was, and felt that particularly if anyone running for president, there are all kinds of questions that they get asked. And a number of people said, a presidential candidate ought to be able to answer that kind of a question fairly easily without creating any questions or uproar, and focus on the things they really want to focus on. But it was in that context that I asked the question.
Lastly, a couple weeks ago, a Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid said he wouldn't run again in 2016 and that he's backing New York Senator Chuck Schumer to replace him as the number one Democrat, even though he's now number three, over Illinois' own Dick Durbin, who is number two. A lot of people are surprised at the move, and Durbin, by the way, might even have to fight for the number two spot in 2017. Any idea what happened there?
Well, I think that Senator Schumer is a very strong inside player. He knows how to play the inside game. And I think that over time, he had been able to win Senator Reid's allegiance on this. And as a result, appears to be able to leapfrog over Senator Durbin to be the Senate Democratic leader. I think some people were surprised, but I think a lot of other people were not. That I think a lot of people thought that in the long run, whenever Senator Reid decided to step down, that Senator Schumer probably was the favorite to be the Senate Democratic leader, though not necessarily unopposed for it.
Any closing thoughts as we, the voters, look forward to the next, I don't even know how many months until November 2016?
Well, people have a long time to evaluate the candidates. And, the press is going to be way ahead of a lot of people in examining this or that aspect. I think what I would say is for the average person take all the time you need. You've got a lot of time to think about these candidates. There's no reason to make an early decision about who you want to support. Listen to them to the extent that you have an opportunity. Ask them questions. Find out more about them. Take nothing for granted about them. And you talked about the fact that we have long campaigns. We do. We have very long campaigns. But there is something about those campaigns that reveals the character of the candidates, their issue positions, and their readiness to be president. And people do not have to make a decision in April of 2015 about who would be the best president come November 2016. So I would say take all the time you need.